Hello and welcome to another podcast. Brian Green here, sitting in for Brian Green, who hasn't been able to make it for the last 4.5 months through to busyness. So I'm glad that Brian can be here today on behalf of Brian. I'm sure Brian is delighted. We want to deal with a couple of topics and let you know that we've a fair few podcasts stored up that have to get released soon. Soon would be good. Anytime soon, get them out, get them off the post-production table and be gone. That would be wonderful. Soon. We look forward to that. Some great music ones and arty sort of things, so listen out. What I want to deal with today, two quick political points. Hopefully they'll be quick. The first one is, long ago I promised I would deal with the issue of the mobile phone mast in Bayside through way of podcast, but due to self-censorship and, you know, the lack of information coming out from the council or from the phone company during the debacle, I decided I would wait till the very end of the saga to voice my exact opinions and understandings on what exactly happened, how it happened, and how the battle to remove an undocumented and unwarranted mast. Actually, take away those words, undocumented and unwarranted. A mast that had absolutely no right to be there under planning law. So, it goes back to February 2009 when an application came in from the Meteor Mobile Phone Company to place an antenna under an exemption rule of the 2001 Development Act on the roof of the Squash and Leisure Centre in Bayside. And having seen this, we were contacted by some local residents and we sprung into action and decided to have a public meeting about this and to object to it being sited there because it was clearly in contravention of planning laws to place an exempted mobile phone antenna above a creche which was operating on the ground floor of the building, the Squash and Leisure Centre in Bayside. So we contacted the council through a Socialist Party councillor and we set up the meeting, and in the course of setting up the meeting, maybe a day before the meeting was to happen, I was contacted by the councillor from the Socialist Party and told, Meteor are not going to be successful in that exemption application. It's not going to happen. The council have seen the points and they are not going to be granting it. And then later that same morning, I got a call from the developer who owns the building to tell me that the meeting I was planning to have, would I be still going ahead with it because Meteor were not being allowed above on the roof. It was done and dusted all over. And I said I would have the meeting anyhow to explain what's going on. And I asked him what was operating on the roof at that time. And common knowledge would be that there was nothing operating on the roof of the building that was in question. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I described the antenna and the boxes and the equipment above the roof. And he said, that's a booster for Vodafone, which was a surprise to me. Maybe it shouldn't have been because Comreg gave it a number and put it on the map on siteviewer.ie and it was there listed as a legitimate mobile phone 3G Vodafone site. And with that, we sprung into action to check out the validity of this because we had never seen any applications in that area. And lo and behold, we couldn't find any planning. When we contacted the planning department in Fingal, neither could they. And they went digging around and came up with, going to take a long story short, various reports and versions of reports, and rested on the fact that it was legitimate, the report was given, and all was well with what was seen there. So with that, we responded to the council's position and gave them a full information on what we could see being the situation on the ground in that area. We had knowledge now from this report that there was an exemption applied for. on a date in, I think it was 2005, I'm not looking at notes at the moment, and that they had adhered to all regulations and everything was installed according to regulations. We believed that the mast had only been put up in July 2008 and not anywhere near the date of an application for an exemption in 2005. So we looked at the dates and we shook the tree, as you do in these things, and found that the date of the application postdated the existence of a company registered at that premises who were involved in childcare. And we looked at aerial photography and demonstrated through 3D bird's eye view virtual earth photography that there was no mast prior to about May 2008, and post May 2008 there was an antenna sighted on the roof, and presented this and other findings and disagreements, as particularly with regard to the link dish that was attached to a domestic dwelling above the hairdressers at the shops. And we gave all this information to the council, and for about 8-9 weeks they worked on this information, and eventually, sometime after the election, they came back and said, yes, that's an unauthorised development and we'll be sending a warning letter to Vodafone, which they did. And a couple of weeks after that, Vodafone, without any argument, decided to come out and take down the equipment, and the said mast has gone. It seems that they were granted an exemption, which they should not have been granted at the time, which leaves a lot of questions to be answered by the council on this matter and the planners. So that is the saga. Obviously, I'm here alone and was one party to the arguments. There are other parties and they can express their understandings of what went on through their own media vehicles, or they can have a right to apply through this podcast if they would like. I do hope that they do, because what we're at here is not the elimination of mobile phone technology. See, the funny thing is, and I think the guys in 3G, when they met me on the Baldoyle Football Club issue, got to know, is the irony is that somebody who has such affinity and affection and love of telecommunications, technology and broadcast, Brian Green, has a history steeped in this stuff, is so adamant that community has a say in the sensible siting of mobile phone masts and antennas attached to buildings and structures under exemption rules, which really they should not be there. They don't give any assist, as has been proved in Bayside and Baldoyle in recent years, to phone companies to site things quickly or easily. The perception might be there that they are able to do things this way, but if you check things out, not everything is always 100% legitimate. And what we would be seeking is that the community are involved through the process of deciding where antenna are going to be placed. The jury is out on the health issue. They're not coming in anytime soon. You will have one group of scientists backed with information, backed by funding from certain location, coming up with a particular answer, and the complete opposite in the other direction. Learned scientists coming out with other information saying something completely opposite. So, in the absence of a definitive answer on health, the common approach in the industry and in the in civic community should be the precautionary approach, where people take a careful look at what they might be doing to their environment in the electromagnetic radiation injury side of things. So if in doubt, leave it out and keep it away from children, whose endoskeleton and absorption of radiation and all that has been proven to be greater than that of a fully grown adult. So with that said, I'll leave that point and move on to something a little bit more pressing. If you're hearing lots of noise, it's because Charlotte's trying out high heels. Okay, somebody's at the door. Hang on a sec. There was nobody at the door. She's going on about something else, I think. Squeak of chair, creak of neck. Lisbon, I have been out on the ladders and on the doorsteps for the last while, for the second half of the summer, really, dealing with On Board SNP, NAMA, Commission for Taxation, and Lisbon issues, and never rest from doing those kind of things. On Monday last, the Socialist Party, which I am a member of, had their first press conference on the Lisbon Treaty. They're advocating a no vote, as they did previously in 2008. And in that press conference, a very interesting argument came up. It was a press conference that was focusing on one aspect that the Socialist Party will deal with. They will deal with other aspects through the campaign on militarism, on privatisation. But this issue was on workers' rights, and that's what we started with. And in that press conference, Councillor Mick Barry from Cork raised a case from Europe that should send shockwaves through groups who think that the Charter for Fundamental Rights is A-OK for workers, and they would be groups like SIPTU and the Labour Party, who think that everything's fine in that department. And it should send shockwaves through anybody who is thinking about the safety net that is the Charter for Fundamental Rights. We voted no in great number, and that's what was so significant about Lisbon 1, because Nice 1 was voted down with a very small number of people, and Lisbon 1 was voted down with a large number of people. So the government went away and had a survey done to see why do the Irish people vote no in great numbers. Cost about €156,000 or maybe even more. And with this information, they went to their colleagues in Europe and got some legal guarantees, promises. Oh, politicians' promises, basically. The thing on the commissioner wasn't even done under a politician's promise. It was sorted out in a gentleman's agreement under the Nice rulings. So they got a few political promises, which we know aren't worth the paper that they're not written on, or are written on, or printed on. And these can be lodged with, you know, the Anglo-Irish Bank or the United Nations or whoever they want to lodge them with. They've got these guarantees. But significantly, one of the biggest issues that the survey found that was why people voted no was on workers' rights. And no guarantee, no political promise has been achieved. No protocol, no changing of any of the words of the Lisbon Treaty have been achieved by our politicians, Irish politicians, out in Europe with regard to getting change to make the treaty more palatable. It's no more palatable in the end of the document that deals with workers' rights. It's exactly the same. There's not even a politician's promise on the issue. So with that regard, well, let's have a listen to Councillor Mick Barry from Cork. And he's speaking last Monday in the Davenport Hotel at the Socialist Party's first press conference, and he's dealing particularly with the Luxembourg case, which we'll come back to and talk on more in a moment.
I'm now going to call on Councillor Mick Barry. Mick is a Socialist Party councillor in Cork, to outline the effect of some of the judgments of the European Court of Justice over the past period.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Well, during the last Lisbon campaign, the European Court of Justice rulings in the Laval case, the Rufford case, the Viking case were part of the debate. And I'm starting here on the premise that the ladies and gentlemen of the press are very familiar with the details of those three cases. I want to deal with a new case which has emerged since the Irish people voted last June, and that is the so-called Luxembourg case. Now, it was only 1 week after the Irish people voted last June and rejected the Lisbon Treaty that the European Court of Justice handed down their judgment on the Luxembourg case. This was a case that the European Union Commission had asked the courts to rule on in relation to some of Luxembourg's labour laws, particularly as they related to the implementation of the Posting of Workers Directive. The effect of the court ruling was to say that national labour laws in the case of Luxembourg protecting foreign workers represented an obstacle to the free provision of cross-border services. It was a very detailed judgment, and I don't have time to go into all of the details of it, but let's look at some aspects of it. Prior to this ruling, the national labour laws in Luxembourg indicated that a company posting workers from another member state, and indeed any worker in Luxembourg, would have to receive a written contract or an equivalent written document, would have automatic indexation of their wages to the cost of living, and that service providers would have to make available to labour inspectors on demand basic information necessary for the monitoring of workers, including posted workers. The court ruled that Luxembourg had overstepped the mark in relation to the Posting of Workers Directive in all regards here. That, for example, the requirement for a contract was a requirement that was applicable to the member state where the country had posted the workers from, rather than the country where the workers had been posted to, in this case, Luxembourg. Noted in the judgment that Luxembourg's cost of living indexation related to all wages, not just those in the minimum wage category, and felt that the state of Luxembourg had failed to establish that a serious threat to a fundamental interest of society was at stake in this regard. Indicated that Luxembourg law was not sufficiently clear to secure legal certainty for foreign service providers, and that the obligation on service providers to provide documents before work began constituted an obstacle to the freedom to provide services. Now, this judgment has very wide-ranging implications in our view. The ruling further reduced the remaining possibility provided for by Article 310 of the Posting of Workers Directive of imposing national labour law standards on employers from other member states posting workers to a host member state. And in so doing, throughout the whole of the European Union, in our view, the ruling served to undermine attempts to A, secure decent wages, B, defend collective agreements, or C, monitor labour standards in an effective way. As I say, very wide-ranging implications throughout the EU. Now, in our view, and Joe will talk about this some more, this ruling would not in any way be undermined by the passing of the Lisbon Treaty and the incorporation of the Charter of Fundamental Rights into European law. On the contrary, the passing of the Lisbon Treaty would serve to copper-facet this judgment, in our view, by further subordinating the Charter of Fundamental Rights to the EU's internal market, making that part of treaty law. In conclusion, I would like to state that I believe that had this ruling been made not 1 week after the Irish people voted on Lisbon in June of 2008, but if it had been made 1 week before, in my opinion, that treaty would not merely have been defeated, but would have been hammered. And I would say now at this stage that should this judgment, the Luxembourg judgment, and the other judgments I referred to, Laval, Rufford and Viking, become fully understood by Irish workers before polling day on October 2nd, then I think that there is every possibility that this treaty can be defeated once again. Thank you.
5 minutes, 30 seconds of clarity and explanation that clearly shows to workers what is in store under the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which exists as a document. It's not new. What makes it newer is that it'll be included in the Lisbon Treaty. So thanks to Councillor Mick Barry for that. The reason why I air it in the podcast today, and I've now got thoughts to stick it out there on its own in its 5-minute piece to explain to people who would rather look the other way when it comes to this issue, that it is real, it is there, and it's within the last year that this has happened, that, you know, they want to realise what it is. And then if I've got it wrong, if we've got it wrong, explain to us clearly what we have so wrong, because I can't see it from here. But the reason why I bring it up is that in arguing and convincing and explaining to people on the doorstep, I was asked clearly, what was it that happened in Luxembourg? So I had to refer back to my notes and read up online and see what it was. And it's there in black and white on the net. Let's see if I can just find it again. The European Trade Union Confederation, I'm sure CIPTU and Labour have heard of them, have it all over their website. The Commission v Luxembourg case involves important questions of interpretation of the Posted Workers Directive 9671EC, the PWD. The European Commission argued that the Luxembourg legislation transposing the PWD violates the terms of the directive. The Commission has therefore introduced an action against Luxembourg for failure to fulfil its obligations under the treaty. On the 13th of September 2007, the Advocate General gave her opinion, which explained in more detail below. On June 19th, 2008, the judgment of the European Court of Justice was published, upholding the Commission's complaint on all points. So what was it, to clearly answer the question, that Luxembourg wanted to have in Luxembourg labour law that was so unwanted by the European Commission that they took them to the European Court of Justice to have it removed and have them fined for putting it in there in the first place? This is it. The requirement to have written employment contract or a written document established in accordance with Directive 91533. An automatic indexation of remuneration to the cost of living. The regulation of part-time work and fixed-term work. And respective collective agreements. Now, we know from the previous cases of Rufford and Laval that it wasn't about minimum wage, it was the fact that there was no minimum wage in Sweden. But people think that it might be the difference between Ireland's minimum wage and what the core poster says of 184. It's not that 184 is a red herring and it is wrong. That difference in itself would be €6. The difference between a registered employment agreement of a trade union in a country and a minimum wage could be many times more than that €6 difference. And that is what the Lisbon Treaty will enshrine. The Charter of Fundamental Rights will give precedence of workers posted to a country to work at a minimum wage that is legal in that country and not what is agreed legally between trade unions and employers in that country for a particular industry. And there that argument unravels. Discuss, write a reply, contact me. radio@wxtc.net. I hope this comes across with some degree of clarity. And look forward to talking to you really soon with a couple of non-political, non-techie, nice entertainment value podcasts coming your way from this title really, really soon. Take care out there and we'll be back to you, I'm sure, before the 2nd of October. If we're not, do the right thing. Take care. Bye-bye.